On January 12, 2010, the ground beneath Port-au-Prince convulsed with terrifying force. Tu pensais c'est une grosse machine qui passait? My Haitian colleague Evans asked as we stumbled from my collapsing house. You think it was a big truck going by? The question seemed absurd. This was clearly an earthquake, but revealed how unprepared Haiti was for a disaster that would claim over 200,000 lives. With no major tremors in living memory, many initially mistook the shaking for a passing vehicle. That night, hundreds of thousands gathered silently at the crumbled National Palace, its collapsed dome symbolizing the fall of Haiti's central institution. The earthquake had been a great leveler, destroying government ministries and luxury hotels alongside modest homes. Whether in Haiti for decades or hours, in slums or five-star accommodations, survival depended solely on the strength of the structures around you when the faults gave way. Despite an unprecedented $5.2 billion in emergency relief and $10 billion pledged for reconstruction, Haiti remained broken years later. Nearly a million remained homeless, political riots erupted, and a devastating cholera epidemic emerged, likely caused by the very UN peacekeepers sent to help. How could such massive humanitarian efforts lead to such profound failure? Haiti's vulnerability predated the earthquake by centuries. Port-au-Prince sits on a narrow lowland between tectonic plates that collided 60 million years ago. Though earthquakes destroyed the French colonial capital twice in the 1700s, the underlying fault went dormant for centuries, allowing the risk to fade from memory. Haiti's revolutionary triumph in 1804 brought hostility from slavery-dependent nations like the United States, which later occupied Haiti from 1915-1934 and centralized power in Port-au-Prince. The Duvalier dictatorships further weakened the nation. Baby Doc Duvalier's manufacturing-focused policies led to agricultural decline and mass urban migration. By 2010, nearly 3 million people crowded Port-au-Prince in unregulated concrete structures. The state had effectively collapsed, operating on an annual budget smaller than Miami-Dade County's, despite having quadrupled the population. I've directed my administration to launch a swift, coordinated effort to save lives, President Obama declared after the earthquake. With funding that grew from $100 million to $3.5 billion, he promised Haitians they wouldn't be forgotten. Operation Unified Response became one of the largest humanitarian missions in modern military history. 22,000 personnel, 33 ships, and 300 aircraft distributed aid, including 2.6 million water bottles and 17 million pounds of food. The mission successfully maintained civil order with no major riots. The transition to reconstruction faltered. Camps expanded from 107 to 1,500 by July, housing 1.5 million people, many who moved there for services despite having intact homes. Land ownership paralyzed rebuilding efforts. The earthquake destroyed Haiti's land registry, 2,500 handwritten logs, with less than 5% of land properly documented before the disaster, making property rights nearly impossible to determine. In the vacuum of governance, self-appointed camp committees emerged, controlling aid distribution through intimidation. The wealthy received priority, while poorer regions were neglected, revealing a failure to engage local communities in recovery planning. Of the $1.1 billion U.S. emergency assistance after Haiti's earthquake, half went to U.S. agencies, with the rest divided between UN agencies, contractors, and NGOs, leaving little for Haiti's government directly. The UN's cluster system proved deeply flawed. UN humanitarian chief John Holmes privately criticized its poor planning, while the English language meetings effectively excluded Haitians. Leslie Voltaire, a Cornell-educated architect, observed that endless meetings prevented actual progress. At a March 2010 UN donors conference in New York, Hillary Clinton pledged $1.15 billion, framing Haiti's future as either an engine for progress or a regional liability. While Haiti scored poorly on Transparency International's Corruption Index, researchers noted this measured perception rather than reality. A Harvard study revealed inherent bias favoring Protestant, wealthy nations with British legal systems. The eventual compromise created a World Bank-managed fund and the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, co-led by Prime Minister Bellerive and Bill Clinton, balancing Haitian and international oversight. Bill Clinton brought intense focus to Haiti, demonstrated by his hands-on approach during a hospital visit where he connected specific needs with donor solutions. His persistent optimism about Haiti's investment potential, rather than aid needs, led some to view him as the country's savior, earning him the nickname Le Gouverneur among skeptical Haitians questioning his UN Special Envoy role. Clinton adopted economist Paul Collier's development strategy, which centered on expanding Haiti's garment industry to compete with China through low wages, supported by the HOPE II trade agreement for duty-free exports to the U.S. This vision faced local resistance when Parliament proposed raising the daily minimum wage from $1.79 to $5. After pressure from foreign investors and the U.S. ambassador, President Preval reached a compromise: $5 for most workers, but only $3 for garment workers, revealing how economic recovery plans depended on maintaining low wages. 9 months after the earthquake, disaster struck Haiti again when Rosemond Lori-May, a 41-year-old from Maye Village, fell severely ill while traveling. His family soon developed the same symptoms, severe diarrhea and vomiting. Despite seeking medical help, Rosemond died on October 17, 2010. Tests confirmed cholera had reached Haiti for the first time in a century. The outbreak's timing and rural origin raised suspicions, leading investigators to a UN Nepalese battalion base near Mirabalais. There, broken pipes leaked sewage toward the river, while the UN's waste contractor dumped excrement in open pits that often overflowed into water sources used by millions downstream. The Nepalese unit had arrived shortly before the epidemic, having been stationed in Nepal during a cholera outbreak. The disease spread swiftly through the immunologically naive population, with victims succumbing within days. As bodies entered mass graves, UN spokesman Pugliese revealed the Nepalese soldiers had never been tested for cholera, contradicting previous statements. Officials dismissed investigating the outbreak's origin, despite this being standard epidemiological protocol. 3 years post-earthquake, Haiti's recovery faltered. Michel Martelly, the musician Sweet Mickey, won a controversial presidency amid foreign interference. At his blackout-plagued inauguration, he declared, "This is a new Haiti open for business." The United States backed the Caracol Industrial Park with South Korean tenant Seya Trading Co. Despite promises of 20,000 jobs, the project drew criticism for tax-free profits and low wages, while Seya's labor practices raised concerns. UN peacekeepers brought cholera, devastating the population. As luxury hotels rose, most Haitians remained in unsafe housing. The Recovery Commission expired with unfunded projects, while camps were cleared without sustainable solutions. Haiti's experience offers vital lessons. Post-disaster riots rarely occur, rushed aid can harm, and donations often miss survivors. As climate disasters increase globally, we must choose between building resilience or dependency, strengthening local institutions or weakening them. True recovery demands supporting local leadership, preserving dignity, and addressing the structural inequalities that turn natural events into catastrophes. Our responsibility extends beyond immediate aid to fostering resilient communities.